I'm on staff here, I work in the store. And my purpose in presenting this session is because, about solitude, is because that's an integral part of what I have to have in my life to function. And Holden gives it to me in many ways. And what I thought I would do is to share, is to have, provide an opportunity for all of us to share what solitude really means, what your own definitions are, why that's comfortable for you, why it might not be comfortable for you, what you think goes on. And then, in addition to our discussions, I'll be using quotes, short quotes from three books, Bonhoeffer's Life Together, Richard Foster's Celebration of Discipline, and Henry Nouwen's Out of Solitude. And then I'll, out of the organization of this, we can discuss and ask questions, because it's really a session that I'd like to be all of us participating in, and see if we can create an experience or a desire for an experience for you that you can practice while you're at Holden. One of the things I'd like to do is to start off by talking about what solitude means to you. And out of your present definition, I'd like you to look back and see what you grew up with in terms of solitude. Because in this culture, being alone by yourself is not a positive aspect of our culture. How many of you have been sent to your rooms to be alone for punishment, for example? Anybody? That can't help you feel good about being alone, I don't think. It didn't help me. How many of you heard that idleness is the devil's handiwork, or whatever that quote is?
Here we sit.
What other things did you grow up with? About silence, about solitude, about being by yourself, about not being productive. Quotes, productive.
Children are quiet, they're usually getting into trouble.
Okay. Anything else?
I was always too busy helping my mother to be quiet.
Okay, so you didn't have much alone time.
No.
Okay. How about the rest of you?
No, I was from a big family, and there wasn't much time to be alone, but there was also the idea that we took care of time by doing things. Working or playing constructively. My father was very good at that kind of thing. That's as we were real little. Mm-hmm. But I do remember going to my room. I'm sure that my parents got fed up with seven of us once in a while.
Okay. Any of the rest of you have some comments?
Yeah, I think that I did base my solitude mainly because growing up, during my childhood, it was all work and no play. And not being able to play with the other children kind of gave me to where I didn't know how to communicate with them. You know, and mm-hmm. I feel that it's very important with my children anyway that they do associate with other kids as they grow up, you know, so that they can. Don't have the solitude that I do.
Yeah. Okay, so it sounds like solitude for you is loneliness.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, for me, I'm an only child, and I was raised in a single-parent household. And so I spent a lot of my childhood up in the tree in our yard, just sort of watching. And I liked that. I was lonely, but I liked it. It was really serene and good for me. How many of you think of solitude as passive? A doing nothing, or a withdrawing from. No? What do you think? I see some yeses and some noes. What do you see it as if you don't see it as passive?
I'm very active when I'm alone. And yet I...
It's like doing...
Yard work,
okay.
Anything that I'm doing.
Okay.
I too was an only child, and it made me very introspective. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily alone, but I mean, thinking about myself and the world and everything.
Okay, so you did a lot of thinking during that time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I identify with that. I think to me the solitude is a retreat, but it's a retreat time during which it's the interior kind of activity takes place. opposed to the kind of hands sort of thing. Okay, that makes sense to me.
A lot of people consider solitude as sort of gazing at your navel, meditating upon your navel sort of experience. And what I'm hoping we can do here is draw some quotes from these books in order to see that it's, well, I'll give you my definition of solitude. Solitude is an act of faith in human and divine relationship. I'm going to say it again. Okay. Solitude is an act of faith in human and divine relationships. And what I mean by that is you really need to trust the people around you in order to go away from them. And you also need to trust in God that He's going to be there when you're there for Him. Okay. Do any of you have any definitions of solitude? Like those one-liner sorts of things?
Peace.
Peace? Okay. Any others?
Healing.
Healing?
Refreshment.
Refreshment?
Renewal.
Okay. That all sounds wonderful.
Rest.
Rest.
Oasis.
Oasis. Okay. Anything else?
It's the other side of our busyness that allows us a balance in life from the active action, the people side, which can be as unproductive as the kind of nothing solitude.
Mm-hmm.
And so with the balance of action in solitude as well as inaction in community, you have the other side of that.
Good, yes.
Jan, I have a question. Would you like me to see if you can find a better space, bigger room? It would only take 2 minutes once you figured out where it was.
The concern is moving all the equipment, Holly, and we have to stop by 5.
Okay.
And I'm afraid if we move, it's going to take more time than we have.
Okay.
Thanks for the thought, though. I'm sorry if you're uncomfortable. We didn't expect this many. I did this, when I thought about this, I thought about this in terms of what's positive about solitude and what's negative about solitude, because there are both. So, I'm going to read quotes first of all, and then discuss some of these things. First of all, we're going to start with negatives, just so we can end up with positives. I like that. Okay, one of the negatives about solitude. This is from the book called Celebration of Discipline, which I recommend. It's a super book. It says, one reason we can hardly bear to remain silent is that it makes us feel so helpless. Because he's talking about solitude as a way, solitude and silence are practically the same. And everyone that I've read so far about solitude considers that part of that is being silent. One reason we can hardly bear to remain silent is that it makes us feel so helpless. We are so accustomed to relying upon words to manage and control others. If we are silent, who will take control? God will take control, but we will never let Him take control until we trust Him. Silence is intimately related to trust. Does that speak to anybody? Okay. How do you feel when you hear silence makes us feel helpless because we're so used to controlling each other with words? That speaks to me. Does that speak to anybody else?
It's like being with somebody and forcing conversation, feeling that you've got to keep up the conversation, or being so completely comfortable with them that there can be periods of silence when neither one is saying anything.
Mm-hmm.
You're just comfortable about the whole thing.
Yeah. Check one thing here.
To me, that's the mark of when friendship begins. When I
yes.
no longer have to be talking to somebody to maintain the relationship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go on to another one. One of the things that I used to do when I first started getting into this with my family was get real, tyrannical is the only word that comes. That may be an exaggeration. But it was my quiet time. And I wanted that, and no one was going to interrupt my solitude. And I get real heavy with that, and it was no fun for anybody. One thing Bonhoeffer says is, the silence of the Christian is listening silence, humble stillness that may be interrupted at any time for the sake of humility. It is silence in conjunction with the Word. It's hard not to go to the positives when I read the negatives, but maybe I'll do that. No. It's a whole idea of using solitude as a way to be in touch with yourself and in touch with God so you can be in touch with people. Not to use it to withdraw from people or make that a barrier. Does that speak to anybody? Okay. The third negative. It's called the dark night of the soul. Has anyone heard of that term? What does that mean to anybody? Yes.
I've heard of it.
You've heard of it. Okay, do you not have...
Yes, and I'm struggling with that now. My agenda here this week is reading on spirituality. And I work with trying to understand what that means. I'm not sure I've experienced it. But that, what I'm gathering is it's that time when one feels totally out of touch and purposeless in one's solitude, in one's action, in one's prayer, in one's attempts to reach God, that there is just a barrier all around.
Mm-hmm. How about anyone else? Is that meaningful to anybody else? I didn't know about Dark Night of the Soul until I read this book. Most of my solitude prayer experiences had been fairly wonderful. And the more I got into it, suddenly the experience began to feel bland, benign, boring. So I read this book, and it really began to make sense to me what I was experiencing. What he says here is, the dark night of the soul is one of the ways God brings us to a hush, a stillness, so that he may work an inner transformation upon the soul. It's like even in solitude and prayer, there comes a time when you go to another level, a deeper level. And in order to do that, there's got to be an emptying. And what he says is, every distraction of the body, mind, and spirit must be put into a kind of suspended animation before this deep work of God upon the soul can occur. And I thought, I don't want to do that. That sounds very heavy. I read on, thank heaven. And it says, recognize the dark night for what it is. Be grateful that God is lovingly drawing you away from every distraction so that you can see him. Rather than chafing and fighting, become still and wait. And you may have heard that if you do any meditation. They say, you know, you can meditate and it's wonderful, and then suddenly it's just nothing. It can be nothing for months. And then suddenly there's a great uplifting or upbringing of energy and goodness that comes. And that's the dark night of the soul. And the quote that comes to me when I think of that is, in one Vespers, one of the women said, you can't be healed until you're wounded. And it's a similar thing. And a sort of a PS to this, if you get into solitude, into prayer life in a regular way, and you really want it, you want the blessings that come from that experience, and you begin to encounter the dark night of the soul, what he says is, do not try to explain or justify to other people why you may be out of sorts, why you may be blah. God is your justifier. Rest your case with him. If you can actually withdraw to a desert place, a place of solitude, do so. If not, go about your daily tasks. But whether in the desert or at home, hold in your heart a deep inner listening silence, and there be still until the work of solitude is done. Have any of you ever experienced the dark night of the soul? Is that something that you're willing to share about? if you have.
Jim?
Yeah.
I need to get something clarified.
Okay.
Are you saying that the dark night of the soul is the sort of the dry spell when nothing seems to be happening, and then from that comes new life?
Yeah. Yeah, I had understood it to be, when I first thought about it, I thought it must be when you really hit the depths. But what I understand from this and from other things I've read is that it is in the dryness. Mm-hmm. That even the negative aliveness is aliveness. But this is dryness.
Nothing.
Nothing.
I had a recent experience a few months ago. I had a really bad spell of depression. It was very scary to me, because I didn't think I'd ever be able to get depressed like that again. I mean, clinical depression, you know, just so that nothing affected me the way it should have. I had friends that still loved me and people that cared, and I couldn't feel any of that. And it was really, really scary. And in the very bottom of that, when I was feeling nothing, I mean, it was just, there wasn't any God out there. There wasn't anything. Something in me, and I don't honestly know what part of me it was, said, okay, maybe I'm going to be like this the rest of my life. But let's just pretend like God can still work with that.
Mm.
And it wasn't like from that second on I got better. It's just from that second on I quit being afraid of not getting better. I didn't feel at that moment that everything was going to be okay. I didn't have any inkling that it was going to be okay. It really felt like it was forever. But the fear was gone. And I guess that was one of the most important moments of my life, I suspect, as I look back on it. At the time, it didn't feel like any big deal, you know. But I suspect that was the darkest night of my soul so far.
That was transformed at some point. Yeah, there's something about, I think, when you get to a point where nothing works, and you just finally have to say, I give up. Take it, God, I can't do it anymore. And that's when he does. Now, on to positives. Is anybody ready?
What's the title of your book?
Excuse me?
What is the title of that book?
It's called The Celebration of Discipline.
By Bonhoeffer?
No, by Richard Foster.
Oh.
It's in the library here, in the bookstore.
I'm sensing, and I had forgotten Foster's definition in that sense, because I think that term comes originally out of a man named St. John of the Cross, one of the medieval contemplatives, who lived in solitude as well. And maybe I'm wrong, but I sense, you know, his struggles were more than dryness.
Okay.
And I appreciate this, because I think the term dryness says a lot to our experience. I think for St. John of the Cross, it was a spiritual torture that he found himself in, and it may have been because of his gifts that his dryness became, you know, was even deeper, you know, the pits, but, you know, went on for months for him. And today, with our, you know, our mental sciences, we might have all kinds of definitions for what that was.
Mm.
But I think there's deeper levels of that night of the soul than Foster might be speaking of there.
There's a quote from St. John of the Cross, and he does. Do you mind if I read it? It's a couple sentences. The darkness of the soul mentioned here puts the sensory and spiritual appetites to sleep, deadens them, and deprives them of the ability to find pleasure in anything. It binds the imagination and impedes it from doing any good discursive work. It makes the memory cease. The intellect becomes dark and unable to understand anything, and hence it causes the will also to become arid and constrained, and all the faculties empty and useless. And over all this hangs a dense and burdensome cloud which afflicts the soul and keeps it withdrawn from God.
You have clinical depression.
Yeah. It's much more painful than just dryness.
But I think also he had greater expectations than we might. Maybe to our detriment. Sometimes our spiritual goals aren't great enough, and so our deep night of the soul is not our night of the soul is not as deep. Well, here was a man who had given himself to knowing God in his solitude, and when that was cut off, he felt he was being choked, literally.
Oh, yeah. That's a good
helpful,
point. I'm
helpful.
Glad to have read that quote. That expands it for me. Okay. Did you have a question? Okay. About one of the positives about solitude is, I think, expressed really well in, again, this book. Because he and Bonhoeffer both talk about solitude, and you talked about it too, the balance. And he says, there is a solitude of the heart that can be maintained at all times. Crowds or lack of them have little to do with this inward attentiveness. It is quite possible to be a desert hermit and never experience solitude. But if we possess inward solitude, we will not fear being alone, for we know we are not alone. Neither do we fear being with others, for they do not control us. Solitude is a freedom to be alone, not in order to be away from people, but in order to hear better. It says, we must seek out the recreating stillness of solitude if we want to be with others meaningfully. We must seek the fellowship and accountability of others if we want to be alone safely. We must cultivate both if we are to live in obedience. And Bonhoeffer is very strong on that. That's a part that was hard not to bring up before, is the balance of using solitude in order to be with people in a more compassionate way. Can you see how that's done? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. I think it can even be in solitude when you're with people, mm-hmm. and not be separate from them, but still have that sense of solitude.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to do sometimes. This is a really nice little book. He talks about, in the lonely place, Jesus was made free to fail. He brings all this in context of Jesus seeking lonely places in order to pray. And that sentence really speaks to me, and I'm not sure I quite understand it. So I'm going to throw that out and see if it means anything to you. In the lonely place, Jesus was made free to fail. What do you think he means by that? Maybe it would help to read you the preceding paragraph. To live a Christian life means to live in the world without being of it. It is in solitude that this inner freedom can grow. Jesus went to a lonely place to pray. That is, to grow in the awareness that all the power he had was given to him, that all the words he spoke came from his Father, and that all the works he did were not really his, but the works of the one who had sent him. In the lonely place, Jesus was made free to fail.
Well, it could mean just that he was really open enough to God's will to do what God wanted him to, even if it felt or seemed like or appeared to be failure, according to the standards that most people live by.
Okay.
Free to question God.
Good. Yes. Free to question God. Any other ideas?
I think even in that final aloneness, there for the person was little victory.
Say that again. I missed it.
For Jesus, that final aloneness.
On the cross.
Yes. There was no, for the person at that point, the human person, there was no victory.
Mm.
But in that final aloneness, ultimately there was, because even that couldn't destroy.
Okay. To go on with what Noun says about solitude, a life without a lonely place, that is, a life without a quiet center, easily becomes destructive. When we cling to the results of our actions as our only way of self-identification, then we become possessive and defensive and tend to look at our fellow human beings more as enemies to be kept at a distance than as friends with whom we share the gifts of life. Yeah, there's a lot in there about how being identified with being effective in the world, or to answer the question, what do you do, is a primary question in our culture. So we become easily identified with the results of our job or career or whatever. Okay, and two more little quotes and then we'll go on. To continue on in this thought about how we can be open to our fellow human beings, in solitude our heart can slowly take off its many protective devices and can grow so wide and deep that nothing human is strange to it. Then we can become contrite, crushed, and broken, not just by our own sins and failings, but also by the pain of our fellow human beings. Then we can give birth to a new awareness reaching far beyond the boundaries of our human efforts. And then we who, in our fearful narrow-mindedness, were afraid that we would not have enough food for ourselves, will have to smile. And he's talking about the loaves and fishes. For then we will discover that after having fed more than 5,000, there were still 12 baskets of bread and fish remaining. Then our care for other humans, born out of our solitude, can become a sign of our faithful expectation of the coming day of complete joy. And he talks about the expectation of solitude, that we go into it expecting mercy and blessings. Okay. Let's do one more, couple rounds of quotes, and then we can have some more discussion. What he says here is that the purpose of solitude is to be able to see and hear. Under the discipline of silence and solitude, we learn when to speak and when to refrain from speaking. And the person in the village that shows me that so clearly is Jack Kling. Do any of you know him? Mm-hmm. I just look at him and I get peaceful. If any of you know him, I've never known him to chatter. I've never known him to say anything more than what needs to be said. And he doesn't let me chatter at him either, which I appreciate a whole lot. He just says, peace. And he walks off, and I'm standing there going, do you know people like that? People who speak when the word needs to be spoken and don't speak, and it all turns out just fine? Okay, one more quote about that. It's Henry Nouwen again. Okay, somewhere we know that without silence, words lose their meaning, that without listening, speaking no longer heals, that without distance, closeness cannot cure. Somewhere we know that without a lonely place, our actions quickly become empty gestures. The careful balance between silence and words, withdrawal and involvement, distance and closeness, solitude and community forms the basis of the Christian life. Okay, and one other aspect of solitude that spoke to me too was a response to that thing about manipulating people with words. And what he says is, one of the fruits of silence is the freedom to let our justification rest entirely with God. We don't need to straighten others out. That ever happened to anybody else here?
I had that experience rather recently with a minister. I was teaching preschool and had a problem, just like you say. And I felt that I was misunderstood, and I wanted to make sure that everybody knew that I hadn't meant to do this. And all of he did was just discuss it for maybe two or three sentences. And like you say about Jack Kling, he said, don't worry, peace. I was dismissed. And it was right.
Yeah, that's a gift.
I think we do tend to make too much of those kind of things. Mm-hmm. explanations.
Have any of you been to Quaker services, the Friends Church? I'd love to do that sometime.
Years ago I did.
What was it like?
It's a wonderful experience. All you do is sit there.
Quietly.
Quietly. Mm-hmm. Ladies usually on one side and the men on the other. Eventually somebody speaks. I was mainly a guest, so I spoke very little, but when someone spoke, it was something that was well worth speaking.
Was it on a topic? You know, the topic for the day is silence, and then...
No, not that I remember.
Just...
There's no planned, at least the meeting that I went to, no weekly, you know, plan, as in some places that I've been.
Do any of you have times of silence in your own church services? Long silences, not 15 or 20 seconds. Are you a pastor?
Yes.
Okay.
We've begun to use it more and more, especially because people seem to appreciate it. You have some who don't. Usually as part of the morning prayers. Mm-hmm. Not always as to begin, but sometimes in the middle of prayers. More and more with communion. I think in the Protestant church particularly, we wrap up communion too quickly. Mm-hmm. I've learned from the Catholic Mass to appreciate that sweet silence that follows mm-hmm. the final putting things away at the altar. And the celebrant usually just sits down, and there's just some, for a short space, there's nowhere to go, nothing to do. And it's a wonderful time. We don't always get by with it, but I like to use it at some of those times.
In our church, when our previous minister used to do that, he used to just say, okay, let's have some quiet time. And after about 30 to 60 seconds, lots of foot shuffling, squirming around and whispering and the whole thing. It's hard.
When that happens to me, I usually wait until the shuffling stops. Mm-hmm. That communicates something, too. The other times that I've learned to appreciate, particularly from being often at Benedictine Abbey, mm-hmm. where there's a lot of that kind of space between the readings. So that after our choir sings, before I pop up to read the next lesson or whatever, I will sometimes sit there, and I've had people comment, that's so good because the choir has just, you know, lifted us. Why not let that soak in a while?
Oh, nice.
Rather than, you know, just on with the next act, and, you know, so that worship doesn't become a production, but becomes a sort of time and space. The problem is, then, the discipline of the sermon.
Yes.
So that people... you know, can leave the church at some reasonable hours because they have other plans for the day too. But I find a lot of appreciation for that. One story I really have to tell, because I'm a minister in the United Church of Christ, which is a very diverse kind of denomination and is usually represented also in our congregation, so that we have everything from ex-Baptists to ex-Roman Catholics. And you have all these traditions that you're dealing with in worship. And a small enough congregation, so we have one service. So that everybody has to be patient with everybody as to the various forms we use. So, one of my senior deacons was a man who grew up as an altar boy at St. John the Baptist in the next town. Mm-hmm. And when I was new to the congregation, was meeting with he and another senior deacon one day saying, how are some of these things going? How do you think the people are responding to various worship forms, etc.? Because this was very different. They had been used to a rather routine, this is how we do it, same thing every week approach, and there had been variety. And he said, well, I like that silence. He said, sometimes if I'm done praying and you still are going with your silence, I just say a few more Hail Marys until we're done. And I thought, that's neat to have that freedom. Though he had really left that tradition, that was a prayer form that had meaning for him, mm-hmm. and had that freedom to use whatever, mm-hmm. you know. I thought, well, if he's doing it, so are a lot of other people in their own traditions, and that's to respect the traditions out of which people come, I think, and their experiences of solitude and everything else is important.
Oh, that's nice.
I was surprised and kind of disappointed to find that Holden doesn't use a lot more silence here than in the LBW, we'll say, you know, mm-hmm. silence for meditation, and you get, in the Methodist church that I go to, it's 50 seconds, and here it seems like it's about 20. And it seems to me that a lot of the people that are holding can deal with a few minutes even in some spots, in some of the worship, even in the those late evening Eucharist services
oh,
and
yeah.
so on, we don't really do much of the silence till we're all done.
Till it's all done, yeah.
That surprises me.
How about the rest of you? Have any of you noticed that ahead?
Yes.
I was just going to say that I'm a Catholic, and I know what he's saying. After communion is over, that period of silence is really a blessed time because you've just received the body and blood of Christ. And what better time to talk to him? Mm-hmm. And that's what we use it for, to talk to God. And if you have prayers to say, that's the time to do it. It's just a beautiful time.
Mm-hmm. We have in our church at least once during the service, and sometimes twice. And I think it can be very productive for individuals.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we've talked about solitude. There's some steps on how to do it that we'll just go over briefly and then finish up with whatever discussion you'd like. When I first thought about solitude, I thought of enormous amounts of time. Well, I've got to set aside a half an hour or an hour, and I didn't. And what I'm reading in this book is that you can take advantage of those little tiny moments, like when you're in a traffic jam. Mm-hmm. For me, standing in line to check out at the store.
I'm a teacher when I get to go to the bathroom. Which is, you know, once if I'm lucky.
Yeah, do you all have moments like that where you could use that time to pray? That was neat for me to see. One of the big rituals in my life now that I'm no longer employed is to get up in the morning and have a cup of coffee and read the paper, which is becoming increasingly depressing anyway. So I'm just going to set aside some quiet time as well for solitude. Okay, another one. Oh, okay, the quote that I like about that is that those moments help us to be genuinely present right where we are. Just that. Have any of you been like at Holden? This happens to me all the time. I'm walking along and suddenly I really see what I'm looking at. That is magic time. And that's solitude. Have you experienced any of that? Okay. Another suggestion is to find a quiet place at home. If you have limited space, there was an example of a family that has a special chair in their home, that if anyone's sitting in that chair, no one disturbs, because that's the quiet time chair, which I think is a nifty idea. And another one, if you're to find a place outside the home, for example, during your day, if you can find churches that are unlocked during the day, or just a park in your work vicinity, and just take some time in your lunch hour and be quiet. Another one, to discipline yourself so that your words are few and full. And then to practice that and see, my catchphrase for me is when I start to say, well, comma, I just might as well be quiet because nothing is going to come out after that that's worth hearing. So I just try not to go on after that. And if some of you can find your own signals for that, and then just not say it and see how it feels. And then once you've done that, go on and take a whole day of not saying anything. I can't even imagine. I don't know when you do wear a sign or but just try to. I've done that. I've been at home by myself, but to be with people and not do that.
You can get lessons from Jack Klingman.
Is that right? That's an idea.
I bet he could do a whole day without saying a thing and still communicate like crazy.
The next one is, he says, four times a year, take 3 or 4 hours out of the day and renegotiate with yourself your life goals as a part of your solitude, to give yourself some direction either for your prayer life or for your active life outside your prayer life. And ask some things of yourself. in those times that you can work for and pray for. And then the last one is for him anyway, to take a retreat once a year, a weekend. And I did that just recently with a friend of mine, and Friday night through Sunday afternoon we were at a convent, and it was a meditation weekend. And by Sunday afternoon, we weren't talking, but we just got the giggles. it was wonderful, and it was real strange to walk by people and not, hi, you know, or whatever people do to be in contact, but just to smile or not even to look was okay. It was neat. Have any of you ever done that? And it's neat because the person who's leading it says, don't talk. And so you've got lots of permission not to talk, and you don't have to feel socially unacceptable. Okay, I'm done.
I would add to that, those who work with people a lot, and you don't have a lot of choice, the teacher, clergy, etc., a day off at an art museum is an okay place not to talk.
Good suggestion.
And just to spend time there is very therapeutic.
It's hard because, like at Holden, I really love to be with the people here, but I also need to get away, and I just feel awful when I'm headed off down the trail, and I know I'm leaving people or situations behind that I also like to be at, and I always feel this need to explain myself. But happily, most people seem to know and don't need that. Okay, I thank you for being here.